Welcome to the third statewide call-in show as part of Connecting the Drops, a collaboration on Colorado water issues with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education and Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations. I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder.
And I'm January Jones at KDNK in Carbondale. Today we're looking at the statewide water plan. The first full draft of Colorado's water plan was released on December 10th in 2014, and a final draft is expected by the end of the year. Joining me in the KDK studio is Jim Polkgrant with the Colorado River Water Conservation District. Jim is the Colorado Basin Roundtable Chair.
And joining me in the KGNU studio in Boulder is James Eklund, Director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. James Eklund has the task of overseeing the first comprehensive water plan in the state's history.
And joining us by phone is Chris Woodka, who covers water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain.
James Eklund, as I said, it is you who has been tasked with creating the state's first ever water plan. A draft of that plan went to the governor's office just some weeks ago. A final version is expected by the end of 2015. It's a big, big plan. It's a big, big draft. But could you give us a general overview, certainly the main points, and particularly those that pertain to members of the public, as really we're trying to inspire and engage members of the public to get involved in the water plan?
You bet, Maeve. Thanks for the opportunity. This is a great forum and a great radio show to have the discussion penetrate, you know, beyond the normal echo chamber of the water community that we normally get ourselves into. 5 days of meetings around water are going to be taking place down in the tech center this coming week, and so your timing is perfect. Really, I have to just go back and correct a little bit of the leading question there, though, and that is that I was tasked to do this water plan. That's what makes it unique and really special in Colorado and in policymaking in general, I think. It's that we've got a grassroots process that has been set up since 2005. It's been in operation with Basin Roundtables that have been covered extensively by Chris Woodka, your participant from Pueblo on the show, and then obviously Jim Polkgrant and the Colorado River District have been heavy participants on the Western Slope. So we really have a structure here that is grassroots in nature and allows us to have conversations about our most vital resource and sometimes our most emotional topic. This water plan, we're hoping, is the first of a series of conversations that Coloradans that are not water wonks have about the resource that they all use every single day. So with that, let me get to your question, which was a quick overview of the water plan. First off, just go to www.coloradowaterplan.com and you will find an executive summary that is not long. It's manageable. We tried to write it in, not in water ease, so to speak. We tried to write it with a narrative that people would understand if they're not from the water background. And if you go through it, then you can really dive into the chapters that are of interest to you. We have, starting at the very front, chapter one talks about our introduction and our goal. And really, we have a bunch of challenges in the water space that we're tackling. And those have manifested themselves throughout our statehood, but really in the way we have experienced them in the last 10 years, it's made it really clear that those challenges aren't going away. In fact, they're probably getting more and more robust. And so we need to have a sustained and systemic answer to them. And that's what this plan is about. So you have the first chapter talking about those challenges, systemic drought, legal, and then chapter two sets up our legal and our institutional structure that we find ourselves in Colorado, a local control state with property tax, property law applying to water rights. And so we have private property in those water rights. Then we get to supply and demand and overviews of all our basins that were written not by bureaucrats in Denver, but by people in the basins themselves. And Jim Polkgrant and the River District were heavily involved in that too. And then we get to chapters six through the end, which is really six through 11, that are the bread and butter of the action that we can take as a state. And that's where the exciting stuff is. Talking about the supply side for a second, we have water, about 14 million acre feet, if you want to think about it in really rough terms, falls on the state of Colorado every year. And we have access to about a third of that because we're a headwater state, 18 downstream states depend on water that starts here in Colorado. So two-thirds of our water through one by function of one of those nine interstate compacts that we have with those other states, two-thirds of our water is required to exit the state. So that really, sets up the challenge in supply. And then on demand, we have a population that's growing. We're going to hit 10 million people between 2050 and 2060 if current trends suggest if current trends are kept, and that's something that, over half that growth is going to come from our own kids, people that live here in Colorado. So I've got three kids. One of them's named Maeve. So I guess I'm part of that problem. Six and seven are the chapters that really get into that. How are we going to confront this this gap, this looming gap between supply and demand? And then we get into the Colorado Way Forward, which we think is setting up a way to safeguard our water and use it and manage it and have a discussion with Coloradans that is open, it's transparent, and it gets us to a path that we all look back at and say that was the right thing to do.
We're going to give out lots of information during the show as to how members of the public can continue to weigh in on the water plan. But James, I'm just going to ask you a quick follow-up question before we get to our other guests. Given the overview of the draft plan that you've just discussed there, what aspects of the plan do you think need the most public discussion before they're settled? Are there still things that are very much up in the air and that the public really needs to get to grips with?
Absolutely. Maybe one of the first things that I encourage people to do is just get informed on the topic. I know that there are barriers to grabbing a hold of a topic that is the lore and the complexity of water law in Colorado, but don't let that dissuade you from getting involved in this conversation. It's a lot like healthcare. I really need healthcare to work effectively personally, but it's so complex and convoluted that sometimes I just turn that over to my healthcare professional and hope they figure it all out. Water is sometimes treated the same way, but we're really trying to break down barriers to entry to this conversation. And I'm really interested in radio shows like this and other places where we get outside the water echo chamber and have a discussion.
Well, if you could just maybe briefly mention a couple of points that you think are very pertinent to the public, whether it's conservation, whether it's policy, what do you really think the public needs to get involved
in? Yeah, so in dealing with those challenges that we have a number of tools that are at our disposal. One of them is conservation. And the governor said time and time again, every conversation about water needs to start with conservation because that's something we can do. The less we use, the smaller the gap between supply and demand is. So that's fundamental. But it won't solve all the problems for us. So we've got to look at a package of solutions, and some of those other points that we need people to engage on are, the agricultural market and the farms and ranches on the Eastern Plains and on the Western Slope are the places where the market goes to for people who are thirsty or municipalities that are thirsty to get water. They get into transaction with those ag producers. And that the trajectory that we're on is so much of that land being bought and dried. We call it buy and dry, where you buy the land and the water rights, and then you transfer the water off of the land. We know that that's not a sustainable thing. We know that Coloradans are, they value their food growing locally, and they value seeing where it comes from. And that's something that we think is a trend that will continue. So we need people to engage on, if we're not going to take as much water from the irrigated agricultural sector, where is that water going to come from and how much of it are we going to use? So conservation, ag buy and dry, every year we take around 500,000 acre feet from the Western Slope, where 70 to 80% of our precipitation falls every year, and we bring it to the eastern side of the state, where 90% of our population is. And that you know, through 25 to 30 Trans Mountain Diversion tunnels and ditches. And that is something that we need people to engage on, because, you know, that's a practice that a lot of people on the Western Slope get very, very nervous about. I'm originally from the Western Slope, and you know, you don't want to balance the back of, you know, the balance the solutions for these challenges or to these challenges on the back of the Western Slope. You know, you've got to grow differently. We start talking about land use patterns here real quick, Maeve, and that's something we need people to engage on too.
That's James Eklund, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. My guest here at the KGNU studio is part of our Connecting the Drops call-in show. Over now to January Jones at KDNK.
Thank you, Maeve. And I'm here with Jim Pokrand from the Colorado Water Conservation District. And in listening to this conversation, we're talking about the Western Slope where we are here. Jim, what do you think about the perspective of people in the Western Slope, how that might be different from the rest of Colorado?
Well, the issue is future water development. As James pointed out, we already send about 500,000 acre feet or more to the front range through Trans Mountain Diversions. And there's pressure in the four tools that James talked about to build another big Trans Mountain Diversion at some point. Some would hope sooner than later. The issue is that in all of Colorado that uses Colorado River water, you have an interest in the Colorado River Compact, which actually puts a ceiling on how much water can be developed before down basin states say, hey, you're not sending enough to us. So the concern is if we go to a big Trans Mountain Diversion without being very thoughtful and understanding hydrology, without using the water resources that we currently have, we could overdevelop the river, and that puts West Slope agriculture in jeopardy. And in the event of a compact curtailment, which would be still fairly far off, West Slope Ag could be the sacrifice zone. But what's interesting in the current day is that because of declining hydrology, we're looking at lake levels in Meade and Powell, two big issues on the Colorado River that take care of upper basin interest and lower basin interest. And there's a concern that lower levels in these reservoirs could force reduced power generation if cut it off altogether at Powell, and which could send Lake Mead below the level where Las Vegas could take water. So right now we're talking about how to deal with that in the current time. So it's interesting that we're worried about lake levels. We're talking about how perhaps conservation, voluntary conservation, demand management might be something to deal with that, and at the same time we want to think about perhaps another big Trans Mountain Diversion. So the larger issue has to deal with the compact, but right here today, foreshadowing that issue are operational issues that could affect Colorado.
Well, putting it into simpler terms for the public, are we talking about having to redefine how we live and use water? Do we have an identity issue here? Are we in denial that we are in an arid climate in Colorado?
I don't know if we're in denial. It's just not the 1950s or 60s anymore where there was plenty of water and there was good water projects and we could landscape as if we still lived in where we got 40 inches of rain. A lot of us came from other areas. But Colorado is arid. You get 5 to 6 inches in some places, 12 to 13 in others. And fortunately, high up in the mountains, you can get 40 to 6 inches. So that's been our salvation over time. So since it's not the way it used to be, we have to look ahead more creatively. And James raised the land use issue. That's an important one. So really, the future, I think it's going to be a contest of how much outdoor landscaping do we want in wall-to-wall carpeting, looking like we were from around Chicago or North Carolina or Philadelphia, or how much do we want to reckon with where we live.
A major issue in this discussion is about agriculture. Chris Woodka with the Pueblo Chieftain, you've been reporting on water issues in Colorado for 30 years. And you have some keen insights into how agriculture and water issues have affected your area.
Yeah, I thank you for letting me be on this show. I have found over the years that I thought Jim Pokrant's comment on overdeveloping the river was interesting because ours has been overdeveloped for some time. And in fact, because of interstate compacts and because of buying expeditions by large cities down in the Arkansas Valley, we've already lost about 150,000 acres of farmland that at one time provided a good economy for the people down here. I think that the state water plan, its first goal is to meet the gap in the cities, and its second is to stop the buy-and-drive agriculture. In the Arkansas Valley, you can come see the buy-and-drive of agriculture. You can go to Crowley County, and you can see businesses that aren't there anymore, and just basically a dying Main Street. We don't want any more of that to happen in the Arkansas Valley, and that's been our emphasis on, I think our roundtable has come down pretty hard saying that we need to recognize the economic value of agriculture as well as these other values in the state. And I think agriculture water was taken for so long because it was the easiest water to take. Yeah, the other day I was talking to a 75-year-old farmer, and he said we were asleep at the switch in the 1980s when that happened. And so, as well as looking ahead, I think in the Arkansas Valley we're always looking back and trying to discover ways that we can use water more intelligently where we don't dry up entire communities.
And that's Chris Woodka from the Pueblo Chieftain. Thank you for that perspective, where your area has been really hit with that loss of water, the impact on what was farmland now can't have those same purposes of the water. We're going to throw it back to Maeve at KGNU.
Thank you, January. Thanks to all of our listeners tuning in all around the state here to KGNU, KDNK, KRCC, KBUT, and many other Rocky Mountain Community Radio stations. We're going to just take a brief pause to let stations identify themselves. Just a reminder, you're listening to a statewide call-in show on Connecting the Drops. It's a year-long collaboration with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education and Rocky Mountain Community Radio stations. I'm Maeve Conran at the KGNU studios in Boulder with my guest, James Eklund, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. At the KDNK studio, we have Jim Pokrant with the Colorado River Water Conservation District, and joining us by phone is Chris Woodka. He covers water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. We'll be right back here on Connecting the Drops.
Welcome back to our statewide call-in show looking at the water plan for Colorado. I'm January Jones at KDNK in Carbondale with guest Jim Pokran and the Colorado River Water Conservation District. Jim is the Colorado Basin Roundtable Chair.
And I'm Maeve Conran at the KGNU studio with James Eklund, who is the director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. And joining us by phone, we have Chris Woodka, who covers water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. We do have calls coming in from around the state, and we're going to go to our first caller, Rita from Trinidad. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Yeah, so we had a problem here in Trinidad Lake. I don't know if you understood. They drained the lake twice to kill the bad fish. And this is our Range Lake, Monument Lake, and they've actually turned into trans-species fish. So There is a monumental issue, not just that it's named Monument Lake, but about Colorado and its people and what happens when we are invaded on our border here. So do you understand what the significance of trans-species fish in Monument Lake is? I would like to ask all the panelists that.
Well, we'll go to James Eklund first. What's your knowledge or your understanding of trans-species fish?
You bet, Mae. So, you know, the issue is something that our Colorado Division of Parks and Wildlife deals with daily, the invasive species. And you can talk about it in terms of fish or invertebrates or the mussels, the quagga mussel and the invasive species that really get into these systems, and we have a really hard time. It's a costly endeavor to try and get rid of them, and in the process, some of them will go ahead and consume some of the endangered fish that we're really trying, again, spending a lot of money and time and energy to try and preserve. So it's a big issue. It's in pretty much every river basin in the state, and I can tell you that Colorado Parks and Wildlife has a team of folks that really roll up their sleeves on a daily basis and take that on.
Is this something that the water plan can address? I mean, this seems to be different from the rather huge topic of just the quantity of water that's not really available to the state.
Yeah, it's I'm fond of saying, Maeve, when you pull the thread, you get the sweater in water. It means that, you know, you can really touch almost anything having to do with any topic. And this is really directly related to reservoir storage and how we manage our storage. So we know that if we're going to see a continuation of the 2-degree warming we've seen over the last 20 to 30 years in Colorado, that our hydrograph is going to shift to earlier. We're going to have earlier runoff, and that means that we have to store very wisely. And that existing storage capacity is directly related to what's growing in those reservoirs. So, and the fish that are downstream of them.
Well, Rita, thanks very much for calling in from Trinidad. We have a lot of callers from all around the state waiting to join us. But I just want to ask Chris Woodka, who writes about water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. Chris, we've really been talking about how the public can be engaged with the water plan. I know that you were attending some of the public meetings and the build-up to the release of the first draft. What do you feel about public engagement? I mean, how do you feel members of the public are responding to it? What were some of the concerns you were hearing at some of those public meetings?
Okay. I really appreciated James Eklund's comment about the echo chamber, because that's the most noticeable thing that I that I've learned from going to all these water meetings that were held for probably 15 months in advance of drafting the draft of the state water plan. And you saw a lot of new people coming into the conversation. There were people from Huerfano County who had concerns about produced water. There were people from farming communities who had concerns about their communities. And we got people from all over the basin involved. I think in the old days, when I did water stories, I would mainly be talking to utility managers and state officials. And I think a lot of new voices came out in this. I think we've particularly heard more from the recreational and environmental communities and, other people that you just didn't used to see at water meetings. We have more public officials, county commissioners who are coming to these meetings. So I just have seen a large influx of different types of people that we never saw at these meetings before come in and start talking about water. And that's, to a water reporter, that makes me feel really grateful, because a lot of times I feel like I'm writing this for a specific audience, but it does reach a lot of people.
And Chris, did you see any commonality amongst the concerns being echoed, or excuse me, being voiced by the general public at these water meetings?
Well, it's a lot like that old story about six blind men and an elephant. A lot of people are focused on their own concerns and needs, to the point of excluding the concerns and needs of other people. And I think what I saw at nearly every meeting was kind of an openness where people would actually listen to each other. A lot of the discussions and these meetings, you know, the roundtable meetings go back 10 years, and at first, probably the first 5 years of roundtable meetings, you had a bunch of people in a room who were issuing position statements or on their particular part of the elephant. And what happened about 5 years ago was that there was a lot more listening started to go on, and people would listen and try to understand the concerns. And that also, I think, made people realize that their positions didn't have to be stated so forcefully, and that they became more strategic in the way they started talking about water as well. It's been a very water is a very complicated subject, but as James said, but just like healthcare, and I was thinking the same thing today too. But I think that when you start talking about the issues, then you gain more understanding of it, and it's not so mystifying. And I think that's been a good thing.
Chris Woodke writes about water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. I'd like to go next to our callers. We have somebody calling in from Colorado Springs. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Oh, great. I was wondering if you could comment on gray water systems for residential. I know Colorado recently passed some regulation, but it's pretty hard for people to pull permits to install gray water for residential. And also, can you tell me or clarify, is it legal to collect rainwater or harvest rainwater?
Great questions. I'm going to throw those to James Eklund. What about this harvesting rainwater and also gray water, particularly for residents?
You bet. So let's take the gray water one first. Gray water systems are discussed in the water plan. Let's see. I'm going to flip open my chapter that I have here. It's chapter 6 and specifically 6.3 that talks about conservation and reuse. And, you know, we have a number of touch points for gray water systems to be talked about. One is the codes that are adopted at the local level, building codes, and when you pull those permits, how arduous is it? And, you know, is there incentive to you know, retrofit your existing infrastructure so that you can take advantage of what we now know about gray water systems? And the technology is changing all the time, so we need to be able to harness that. So that point is taken very, very well, and it's something that we're going to continually have to work on and try and make it easier for people to utilize those gray water systems. In the city of Denver, I know that they put in purple pipe. That's the color that the code requires, kind of the uniform building code requires for gray water systems. And when we reuse water in Denver or anywhere around the Front Range, that's helpful, because a lot of that water is Trans Mountain water from the Western Slope, and it needs to be used as efficiently and effectively as possible. The rainwater harvesting question is always an interesting one, because you would think, putting a barrel outside my house, what you know, why would that be a problem? And sometimes it isn't. And there's a pilot rainwater harvesting program going on as we speak that we're continuing to collect data from a pilot that's going on down in the Sterling Ranch area in the southwest metro part of Denver. And the answer is it's illegal to use water that you don't have a property right to use. And the example that you can kind of think of is taking an entire metropolitan area's runoff rainwater, and what do you do with that? If you hold on to that and consumptively use it, well, again, Colorado's shaped as a headwater state, and our water is used 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times before it gets out of the state. So the people downstream really rely on what we kind of refer to as return flows. Sometimes we call them stormwater runoff. And our legal regime, our administration of when you can or can't use water, has grown up around that that system of protecting the people downstream and their right to use it in priority. So the rainwater harvesting question is a great one, and we're going to learn more, just like with the graywater question, about that moving forward. And this water plan is a chance for us to hear a comment like the one you just heard from Colorado Springs, and figure out how we can enable and incentivize people to effectively and efficiently use water, maybe outdoor if they catch it and collect it, and there's not an injury being caused to somebody downstream.
That's James Eklund, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. He's my guest here at the KGNU studio in Boulder, and one of our guests on this statewide call-in show on the Colorado Water Plan. Back now to January Jones at KDNK.
Well, in talking about the gray water and rainwater collections, we've talked about this a little bit. Jim Pokran, I have here with me at KDNK. What has to happen at a municipal level to enable those things or to try to start doing more water conservation for towns and cities?
The water plan actually addresses conservation in depth. There's a lot of words like will and should, and there's, I don't think in the whole water plan you see the word shall. So in our state, a local control state where it's been up to the municipalities to develop water, who have done a great job. I mean, we are the state that we are because of the work that's been done to date. So the whole idea of conservation is how much water can we gain to support future development and not go to the river so much and not go to agriculture? So the Colorado Water Conservation Board did some technical work, and they pointed out that at a high level of conservation, we can develop 461,000 acre feet. That goes a long way to a 500 or 600,000 acre foot gap. The question is, how can we get there in a concerted, unified way? And the water plan, as I said, brings up a lot of ways that this could be done, but it really doesn't fall down on one thing that says this is it. And at this point, it probably shouldn't, given the state that we're in. Nevertheless, the plan does identify a medium level of statewide water conservation that could develop about 170,000 acre feet of savings. We on the West Slope and other West Slope roundtables are hoping that we can aim more closely to that 461,000 acre foot goal. Now, how does that get done in a place where conservation and systems are very different and at higher success levels or not? And that's the million-dollar question, which, to the water plan's credit, it brings up. But looking at that 461,000 acre foot number, That's a good place for the state to look for more water and thus protecting the river and agriculture. How it gets done, that's the question.
Thank you, Jim Pokran, the Colorado River Water Conservation District. We have another caller on the line. We have Chuck from Boulder. Chuck, do you have a question you'd like to ask our panelists?
Hello, panel. Many thanks for your presentations. I think we're all acquainted. The issue I'd like you to address is the fact that with all of our water shortage, Weld County and the South Platte Basin generally has more water than they know what to do with. The water tables are at all-time highs. We're delivering much more water to Nebraska than we're required to by interstate compact. Isn't there some way that we can more intelligently use this to help close those gaps?
Jim, would you like to respond to that?
Well, that's on the other side of the divide, and that's not a new argument. And the question is storage, the will to build storage, and the possible or financial means to do that. And certainly, I'm not an expert on the South Platte, but in general, the West Slope would hope that all basins would best use their water resources at hand before looking to other basins for their, quote, new supply. Mm-hmm. So maybe James could give a better shot at that.
James Eklund, do you have a comment?
You bet. Chuck, it's good to hear your voice. Your question's right on, and the South Platte has a, we place a premium on conjunctive use, is what we call it in the South Platte. It's the kind of, you know, joint administration of groundwater and surface water. And the point that Chuck brings up is that there's more water passing the Julesburg gauge, which is the gauge of reference on our compact on the South Platte. Every, you know, most years we see more water go past that gauge than we're required to let go. And so, you know, we are in the plan itself. We said, you know, we see this as an issue, but, you know, again, to kind of the point that Jim Polkrant raised earlier, we could, you know, wrestle this to the ground and tell you what we think we should do, but we really empowered the roundtables to take on these issues that are in their basin and describe them, try and analyze them, and then figure out solutions to them. And so we're deploying quite a bit of resources on the ground, either to study the groundwater situation in the South Platte, or to try and figure out how we better administer surface water so that we're really using the water that we're allowed to use legally as efficiently and effectively as possible. So I appreciate that question. Colorado is planning for these, you know, whether we're planning for 1 or 2 or 5 million more people moving here, we need to be doing strategic planning and to address the issue that Chuck just raised.
That's James Eklund. He is the director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, and he is one of our guests here at Connecting the Drops, our statewide call-in show. We're going to take a break now for stations to identify themselves, and we'll be right back with callers from around the state. We've got Bruce in Littleton standing by. We've got Jim standing by, and more calls coming in. You are listening to a statewide call-in show, Connecting the Drops, with KGNU, KDNK, and many other stations in the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to our statewide call-in show looking at the Colorado Water Plan. I'm January Jones from KDNK in Carbondale.
And I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder, and we have lots of calls coming in. My guest here at the KGNU studio is James Eklund, who is director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. And we also have joining us by phone Chris Woodke. He covers water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. And actually, I would like to bring Chris on before we go back to our callers. Chris, we're hearing from people all around the state, and as we've heard earlier, people, you know, have very specific concerns according to where they live. Do you have confidence that the public's voice will be heard when it comes to the final water plan, given that you have been talking to members of the public, that you've been going to some of these public meetings? I mean, do you feel that the public is really getting an opportunity to weigh in here and their voices will be heard?
Yeah. I think they're engaged more than they have been in the past. Whether they'll be heard, I think, depends on the political will of the state, and I can't predict how that will go. I've always said that crisis spawn action in water projects, and a slow, gradual growth. It's great that we're planning for that, but as you saw with the floods that happened in the South Platte Basin, and the issue that we were just discussing about the high water tables on the South Platte. In terms of a policy, you don't know how long those high water tables will continue. You do know that you can you can pump the water out and use it while it's there. And I guess just maybe the state water plan will give us a framework to discuss how that can be done and how it can be done more quickly. One of the things that James brought up during a lot of the meetings on the state water plan was that it used to take, as a rule of thumb for a big water project, that used to take 3 years and $3 million to build, will now take 10 years and $10 million to build. That's a kind of an exponential growth that's caused by a number of things, regulation, more people jumping into the conversation, and that sort of thing. But if we can have conversations where we don't have to keep talking the same issues down until everybody's satisfied, and if we have like a framework we can operate out of, I think that would be a big advantage.
That's Chris Woodka, who covers water issues for the Pueblo Chieftain. I'd like to go back to our callers. Bruce and Littleton, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Question is for James Eklund. James, what role do you see produced water playing in Colorado's future?
Thanks for the question, Bruce. Produced water is obviously the, if some of the callers don't know, is the water that is really in the way of the extraction of mineral resources out of the ground. So when you frack a well, you go down and you might hit water that's under pressure and that is sometimes heavily saline, and you've got to get that out of the way. And so you bring it up, and then there's a question of what to do with it. And if it is heavily saline, sometimes this water is not too bad. Sometimes it's much more saline than ocean water, and so you've got to treat it and make sure that its quality is sufficient. But if you're producing enough of it, then you can actually start to move the needle on water availability in a particular micro basin, so to speak. So the treatment, my understanding is the treatment technology is starting to catch up with the industry, and we're starting to see some pretty innovative stuff come out about how to remove the salts and the other things you don't want in your drinking water from the produced water. And the quicker that technology grows and expands, I think the quicker we'll see more basins taking it into account as part of their portfolio.
That's James Eklund, Director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. Back now to January Jones at KDNK.
Thank you, Maeve. We do have someone joining us on Twitter. They wanted to make a comment, Andy Lyon. He says he enjoys water here in Colorado Springs, but he opposes more Trans Mountain diversions. He thinks there's got to be a better way. I wanted to throw it to Jim Pokran, who joins me here in the KDNK studios up here in Carbondale. We kind of feel up here that we make all the water sometimes, right? We've got the mountains. We have to deal with all the snow. And it becomes a point of contention sometimes with everybody else on the eastern slope. How do you think we need to frame that issue so it's not so adversarial?
At least for this season, I wish we were having more snow to be talking about. But for sure, what folks in all of Colorado should understand is that the high mountain snowpack is the biggest reservoir in the state. That's snowpack above 9,000 acre feet. So whether it's on the Continental Divide or elsewhere, that is the major source of renewable water in Colorado. And that was long ago recognized by the folks on the Front Range, and that's why they've built at least 13 major Trans Mountain diversions and many more smaller ones. So that water source is still what's being targeted, but we have to remember that we have to share that water source with the down basin states, as James said, 18 other states, but certainly on the West Slope with six other states and even the Republic of Mexico. So this is also the water on the West Slope that all the folks are on I-70 driving up to every weekend and driving home slowly perhaps. But they're recreating on it, and it's the same idea in the summer. So it's all the same water, And the concept is that the water that you play on could also be the water that is coming out of your spigot on the front range and watering your lawn. So that's the perspective we'd like people to have. And water just doesn't come from your spigot. It comes from a whole system in an arid state.
Thank you, Jim Pogram with the Colorado River Water Conservation District. We have another question here from Doug from Westcliff. Doug, you're on the line.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. This question probably is best for James Eklund, and it's sort of a multi-part question. And I'm wondering how you expect that some of the outcomes from the water plan might affect both state policy and policies of some of the larger municipal water suppliers in the state, and also how it might interact with current water law and how it might affect future water law.
That's a great question, Doug. A lot to unpack there, and I'll do my best. So the outcomes that we're hoping for are A, to really create a platform for progress across all of the topics that we've been talking about here. We know for a fact that the state's policies are constantly changing and evolving. Every time the legislature meets, we have a slate of water bills that make their way through the legislative process, and that's going to continue. And we want to make sure that the folks under the Gold Dome there have a good menu of options to look at when they start talking about water policy and changes to water law. As Doug pointed out, there is that's the, you know, you think of the three branches of government, that's the branch of government that gets to make the law. And we implement it on the executive side and the executive branch. And we take that responsibility very seriously. And we want to make sure that the laws that they are passing in the legislature and that the governor either signs or doesn't sign are good for this conversation and for water use in Colorado. So it's the draft that you see, if you go online and you look at Chapter 10, you're not going to see a slate of legislative recommendations because this is a draft. And in order to honor the process that we're going through, it's really a grassroots process. We have to get final basin implementation plans and the conversation with folks about what they are seeing that we've already produced in order to inform what those are going to be in 2015. But make no mistake, in 2015, we will have a final and it will have legislative recommendations that hopefully influence the direction we're headed on all these challenges.
Great. Thank you.
And we have another question. John's back from Guffey. John, do you have a question for our panelists?
No, actually, the underground water, and I've tapped into two different wells that I've drilled all back in 94 and just recently in 2008. And it's not an aquifer. It is an underground river. I'm 10 miles from Spinney and 11 mile. And my question basically is, are those underground rivers, and I've had a dowser on both of them, you know, located for me, and I've went 200 feet through basalt up here strictly. And, you know, I've hit two 20-gallon-a-minute wells. And he says they are underground rivers. So my question is, do I own that water?
James, do you want to address that?
You bet, January. So the groundwater, you know, in 1969, Colorado did something that was pretty fundamentally groundbreaking in the West. And what we did is we recognized the connection between groundwater and surface water. There are states like California that are just now doing that because of the drought. Being, you know, it took a 500-year drought for them to realize that that was something that they needed to do. So you could drill a well in California and that wasn't really regulated at all. Not so in Colorado. You need to get a permit to drill a well. There are exempt wells that if you're just using it, and it sounds like, I'm not sure, John, if you're just using it for your own personal use or
it is domestic use only, yes.
Okay, so that that usually means that you're in a different class of the regulatory structure. If you're using it to, you know, pump water out of the ground to put on acres and acres of productive farmland, that's a different question. But groundwater is regulated by the state of Colorado, and I'm not real familiar with your territory there, just below Spinney and 11 Mile, but if you're in the alluvial aquifer, we have legally kind of a regime that talks about whether or not your water, your groundwater, is tributary or non-tributary. If it never hooks up with the surface water, then and you can, you know, figure that out through any number of engineering modeling that you can put to, you know, bring to bear on your situation. But if it's not connecting up with the surface, then it's called non-tributary groundwater, and that can you can do a lot of different things with that, because you're not really influencing the stream and the other water users on that stream. If it is tributary, well, then the opposite's true. You've got to demonstrate that you're not injuring another water user, and that's kind of the threshold question, I guess, for your situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds like a real nebulous gray area there, determining whether it's tributary or not.
Yeah, I mean, the way it works is you can hire a water engineer. We've got probably more per capita water professionals in the state of Colorado than any other state. Don't quote me on that, Chris, but I'm pretty sure that's pretty close. You can hire somebody to come in and take a look at that, and they actually have some pretty, you know, it's getting more sophisticated all the time, to the point where I think eventually we're going to be doing essentially, you know, MRIs for groundwater, where we can figure out, you know, acre foot in, acre foot out. And that's important, because, you know, if you step back from John's specific situation, if you look at the entire aquifer and the systems of groundwater that we have in Colorado, it's important to know that, you know, if you stick some water in the ground and you store it underground, you don't lose that water to evaporation. So the issue and the technology is front of mind, and we need to figure out as much as we can as quickly as the technology will allow us.
Okay, well, great. I can't hire my local dowser and have him rubber stamp it, huh?
No, maybe not. Well, if your dowser is that good, then maybe, you know, we should talk offline.
Well, yeah. Oh, he is. He's hit a bunch of wells for me around here. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, that wraps up our caller section. We're thrilled with the response that we've had. So if you have a question that you would like us to throw to our panelists, we can do that offline. Give an email to water@kdnk.org, and we'll try to connect you with the answers that you want.
You've been listening to a statewide call-in show as part of Connecting the Drops, a collaboration on Colorado water issues with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education and Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations. Our guests have been James Eklund, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, and Chris Woodka with the Pueblo Chieftain.
Jim Pokran from the Colorado River Water Conservation District has been my guest in the KDNK studio here in Carbondale. Thanks to Evan Perkins, Steve Skinner, and John Banks at KDNK, and Joe Balik and Andrea Chalfin at KRCC.
Thanks to the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. You can find out more about our radio series, Connecting the Drops, and read more about the water plan in the latest edition of the Colorado Foundation for Water Education's quarterly publication, Headwaters Magazine, and you can find out more at yourwatercolorado.org. For Connecting the Drops, thanks so much for listening.